Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Paul Andrew Hutton is a distinguished professor at the University of New Mexico. He's a cultural historian, an author, a documentary film writer, and a television personality. His most recent book is called The Apache Wars. And Paul Andrew Hutton, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thanks so much, Lori. It's great to be here.
This book begins with a boy in a tree. And so much else begins with the boy in the tree, so I feel like we have to start there. Tell me about this moment that sort of makes everything after it unfold.
Well,
and it's a true story. We're talking nonfiction now.
Yes, this is nonfiction, although even though I am a college professor, it's nonfiction written for a broad popular audience.
Yes,
and
yes.
Jennifer sort of inspired me because I realized as I was listening to her that I was sort of doing the same thing. I got that boy up that tree, and then it's 400 pages telling how he got down from the tree and what happens after that. He was a young half-blood boy. He was part Irish and part Mexican, and he's down in southern Arizona at a time when it was the very edge of the American frontier, and Apache raiders came and took him. He had fled into a little peach grove and climbed up in the tree. There are no leaves on it. I don't know what he thought, but he was taken captive by the Apaches, even though he was 11 years old, a little old to be taken captive. Usually younger children were taken, but he only had one eye, and his captor, an Apache warrior named Beto, also only had one eye. I think that must have been the connection that led him to spare the boy, took him north, and he grew up as an Apache. His kidnapping, though, set in motion a series of events that led to 25 years of unrelenting warfare for the American Southwest between the Apaches and the Americans.
Not something that is as studied as some other conflicts, and you've mentioned even Afghanistan and Iraq have been written about more than this period of time. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's the longest war in American history, but in a lot of ways it's not quite as romantic and glamorous, if we can use those terms to describe the battle between the Anglo invader and natives for possession of the continent. But certainly here on the Great Plains in the Dakotas, it's the story of the Sioux and the Cheyenne and Custer's Last Stand and big epic events. It was low-intensity warfare in the Southwest, and it was skirmishes between handfuls of people on each side, and the Apaches were masters of the landscape. And a tribal society that lived by raiding, and so they were not going to be able to adjust very easily to the coming of the Americans, who first they befriended and helped in the war against Mexico. And they were willing to get along with the Americans and had tried to avoid war, but they wouldn't give up raiding Mexico.
You compare them to the Vikings.
They are.
There's some similarities.
They live by raiding. You couldn't make a living off Arizona and New Mexico. And so they lived by raiding, and they had always been a raiding people. They had come late to the Southwest, as opposed to other peoples like the Pueblo people along the Rio Grande. And they raided Mexico, and when, you know, Spain came in, they thought it was wonderful. It was like a super Walmart had just moved into the neighborhood, and they actually didn't want to kill the Mexicans. They referred to them as their shepherds. And they took their sheep, they took their ponies, they took whatever, they took their people to replenish their population. And of course, raids and counter raids followed, and soon it became just an incredibly bitter, bloody war.
So why does the kidnapping of Mickey Free escalate it beyond what it already was? Why isn't that just another event that sort of happens?
Well, it's 1861. A lot of trouble is going to break out in the East 2 months later. And a young army officer goes to the encampment of Cochise, the great leader of all the Chiricahua Apaches, and demands the return of the boy. Cochise says, "I don't have him." The officer takes Cochise and some of his relatives hostage. Cochise escapes. The officer hangs the relatives. And vengeance is a driving cultural imperative among the Apaches. And now Cochise began a 10-year war of vengeance against the Americans, who, of course, soon withdraw all their troops and go east to fight the American Civil War. And so all the settlements in Arizona are driven out, and the American frontier is actually thrown back for a 3-year period.
And it's this relationship between Cochise and an American that really captured your attention even when you were a child. You thought this story was something that, I shouldn't say an American, I misspoke. So it's the it's Cochise and Tom
Jeffords.
Jeffords. Thank you very much. I forgot his name.
Yeah.
Tell me about that relationship and how you kind of heard about it as a kid, as a young reader.
My mom got me a book from the library when I was 11 years old, and by Oliver Lafarge, called Cochise of Arizona. Oliver Lafarge was a Pulitzer Prize winning writer in the Southwest. I didn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. I loved that book. I was fascinated by it. Years later, I read an adult novel called Blood Brother by Elliot Arnold, which Lafarge had based his book on, and that in turn was made into a famous motion picture with Jimmy Stewart called Broken Arrow, and then also a television series. And I was delighted to discover in writing my own book that the childhood sort of fantasy I had about the friendship between Tom Jeffords and Cochise, which ended, at least briefly, the war and brought peace to the Southwest, was all true. And Hollywood hadn't taken it too far, of course. Yeah. They changed it a bit, but it was a true story, and incredible courage on both sides, both Cochise and Jeffords, to establish trust between themselves and then establish a reservation for the Chiricahuas in their homeland, which once Cochise dies, Jeffords, who had been appointed their agent, was immediately fired, and the government removed all the Apaches to a sweltering sort of hellhole called San Carlos.
You mentioned landscape and the geography of this place a couple times now. You went to these places. You've walked the land in service to your research and service to this book. Tell us what that experience was like for you, just sort of making sure you got those descriptions right and you really understood the place that you were writing about as well as the time and the characters.
Well, I believe it's a historian, and Francis Parkman did this, America's first great Western historian. You've got to go to the place, you've got to walk the ground, you can't understand it unless you see it. Now, there are some places in Mexico I couldn't go, but certainly I went to all the important sites in New Mexico and Arizona to try and understand the relationship of the Apache people to the land, what the landscape looked like, and then be able to recreate the landscape in the book, because the landscape is a character in the book. Mm-hmm. The landscape dictates action, and I had to understand it fully.
Speaking of characters, these are real people we're talking about, but they're such fully drawn out characters in the book and in life. So let's just talk about some of those individuals. Geronimo is here. Tell me a little bit more about Geronimo and really what his significance. I mean, it's hard to understate his significance in this time frame.
I believe Geronimo is the most famous Native American who ever lived, and certainly internationally his name resonates. Part of that is because he became a battle cry during the Second World War, of course, as Americans hurled themselves out of airplanes in the airborne divisions invading France.
Any reason to tied to history for that, or was it random?
He was, when he was captured and eventually imprisoned, he remained a prisoner of war his whole life at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and that's where the airborne troops trained just before the war. And he's buried there, and they would go to his grave, and so he was just a familiar name. But he's also a symbol of ferocity and resistance. He was the one who wouldn't compromise. He was the one who wouldn't make a deal. He was the one who just played his string out all the way to the end, and finally the government broke him by imprisoning all of the Chiricahuas, 500 people. When Geronimo was making his last great raid, he only had 34 people, and he was being pursued by one quarter of the entire United States Army, 5,000 men, by another 10,000 Mexican troops. And the way they got him was that they simply put everybody on boxcars and they shipped them to Florida and imprisoned them in masonry, ancient fortifications there. And all the Chiricahua people, 500 of them, remained prisoners of war until 1909, when Geronimo died at Fort Sill, and then the fear was over. Geronimo himself became a tourist attraction. He went around with various fairs and shows and died with $10,000 in the bank. He really marketed himself, wrote his autobiography, signed autographs. So he was a smart guy in every way he played his life, but he was implacable in his determination to continue the old way of life. And near the end, and he hated the Mexicans who had massacred his entire family when he was young, and that was his determination to continue to raid into Mexico. And he was asked near the end of his life if he had any regrets, and he said, yes, I'm sorry I didn't kill more Mexicans. So this was not a real forgive and forget kind of guy. This was a tough American warrior, and he certainly left a legacy of blood through the Southwest. And the man he feared The only man he ever feared was that little boy who was up the tree. That was Mickey,
Mickey Free,
Mickey Free, a name given to him by army soldiers from a character in a British military comedy novel. And they just thought this was hilarious. And he was a red-headed, one-eyed, freckle-faced Apache. And he became an important scout and interpreter for the army, but caught between two worlds. They didn't trust him. The Apache saw him as a traitor. And he hated Geronimo, and Geronimo hated him, and he becomes one of the most important scouts in this war, a war that's eventually won by the U.S. Army through the use of Apache scouts to hunt down Apaches.
And this is the end of the Apache way of life as they knew it?
It's the end of the old way of life. Of course, Apache people still live throughout New Mexico and Arizona, and some still in Oklahoma because some of them stayed there. And but it was the end not only of the Apache way of life, but of the 400-year struggle between the European invader and Native Americans for possession of the continent. When Geronimo surrenders in 1886, that's the end of the game.
It's a big topic to get your arms around. It takes guts to write about that.
It was a lot of fun. It was a chore, though.
Yeah.
It was a chore. 3 years of my life gone, and I'm getting kind of long in the tooth. You hate to give those up.
You got
to
make choices.
But
now.
it's doing really well, and I'm very proud of it. It turned out well, and I think it's a great story, a great story as well as good history.
We have time for one more character, and I want to make sure to talk about Lozen. Am I saying her name right?
You are saying her name right, and just a fascinating character. She's very controversial, and I was criticized, in fact, by my mentor in the history business, a famous Western historian named Bob Utley, for even using her in the book. He said she doesn't exist, but she exists, and Apache oral tradition tells her story. She was the sister of Victorio, the great Warm Springs Apache leader, and they're forced into warfare by the bungling of the bureaucrats in Washington, and she rides with him as a warrior. She stepped outside of the traditional role of Apache women, and she became a warrior woman, but she was also a seer, and she could tell the future. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when Victoria was finally killed in Mexico in an unbelievably heroic last stand that I think for the Apache Wars ranks right with Custer's last stand in the Northern Plains Wars, she wasn't there. She had taken a pregnant woman back to the reservation to protect her, and so she wasn't there to foretell that the Mexican army was coming to trap Victorio. But then she continued to fight, and she was with Geronimo at the very end. She never gave up. Finally, she died of tuberculosis as a prisoner of war.
We could have a whole nother interesting conversation about the use of oral history for a biographer. So if you're in the audience and you're interested, ask him that question, because we're out of time to ask him that question. But that's a great conversation I'd like to have with you again. Paul Andrew Hutton is the author of The Apache Wars. Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.